Although it was torn apart by genocide that claimed up to a million lives in 1994, Rwanda is now often portrayed as a beacon of hope, modernization, and democracy in Africa. However, Anjan Sundaram challenges this narrative after having spent 4 years there among the country's journalists. In his new book for Doubleday, Bad News, Last Journalists in a Dictatorship, Mr. Sundaram reveals that Rwandan journalists are being viciously suppressed, imprisoned, or killed, and that along with President Paul Kagame's regime, Western powers have been complicit in snuffing out any glimmers of a true democracy. Anjan Sundaram visited us previously to discuss his book, Stringer, A Reporter's Journey from Congo, and I'm pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
On December 18th, 98% of Rwandans voted to allow President Kagame to extend the presidency beyond his current term. Did that surprise you?
Not very much. It's a reflection of how total his control is that the government announced only 10 Rwandans in a nation of 11 million people opposed his changing the constitution so he could run for a third term.
Well, you've spoken to a number of Rwandans over the years. Do you know more than 10 who would have voted against that?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if they... I know more than 10 Rwandans who would oppose Paul Kagame, but who wouldn't dare to in a public forum.
But now, elections are often monitored by outside observers. Did they see this as a fair election?
They reported it as an incredibly orderly election, and that was true. The voting booths were almost empty by 10 a.m. because everyone had lined up. Voting in Rwanda is seen as a national duty. It's almost like vaccinating your children. It's a government order. Everyone has to comply. And if you don't, local authorities ask you, where's the ink on your finger? Because that's a mark of having voted. Why haven't you voted? Are you against our president?
So as a result of that vote, Kagame recently announced that he'll seek a third term in office in 2017, even though there are people who interpret his becoming president, or the, I guess the new constitution, as prohibiting that.
Absolutely. So the constitution previously had a two-term limit, and Kagame had promised to respect that. In fact, he had said if he were not able to find a successor, he would have failed. And he said this many years ago. And now it turns out he's unable to find a successor and he's clinging on to power.
Do you think a transfer of power would be possible without violence?
That looks increasingly unlikely, unfortunately, for Rwandans. And that's a pity.
Now, last time you were here, we talked about your trip to Congo and your reporting there. What led you to Rwanda? The fact that these two countries have a history? In fact, a lot of the turmoil in Congo is directly related to the Rwandan story.
I was offered a job to train journalists in Rwanda, and I thought it was a good place to write Stringer. It was a calm country, quiet, peaceful, and it was on the border with Congo, so I could travel into Congo whenever I sought inspiration. That's the reason I went.
And who funded this program?
It was funded by the European Union and the British government.
And its stated purpose?
Its stated purpose was to promote government-backed programs like that got people to wash their hands or plant a certain crop or go and see their doctor. So it was all in support of government policy. But as soon as I arrived there, the first thing the journalists would tell me was that they didn't have freedom, and they asked me, how did you win your freedom in your countries? How can we win ours?
So you decided to become a journalism teacher.
I was a journalism teacher when they asked me this.
That changed your goal for this program.
In some way, I wrote this book out of a great sense of sympathy for my journalists. I watched them one by one be harassed, imprisoned, forced to flee the country, fearing for their lives. One of my colleagues was shot dead on the day he criticized President Paul Kagame. And I wrote this book in a way to remember their stories and remember what they stood for and what they were fighting for.
And we don't hear much about this. I mean, I have read in the New York Times that there have been troubles in Rwanda as a result of the Kagame regime. But it doesn't sound like the worst place in the world. In fact, if anything, it sounds like one of the successes of Africa. Is that because the journalists are afraid to tell the truth, or is something else going on here?
Rwanda's President Paul Kagame has been incredibly effective at eliminating all democratic institutions and creating very powerful propaganda. And it's been the case often that foreign journalists and foreign observers will come to Rwanda, and because Rwandans are afraid to speak up, they get a sanitized version of events and that they report as fact.
You write about a senior journalist and survivor of the genocide named Moses. He seemed to play an important role in your program.
Yes, Moses was a close friend and someone who took it upon himself to show me things in Rwanda that people would be afraid to see and talk about generally. Moses was a survivor of the genocide. He took me to a genocide memorial.
A survivor of the genocide would mean that he was most likely Tutsi?
Yes. And he nearly lost his life. And when he took me to a memorial, genocide memorial in Rwanda, and what he showed me, he began to cry after the after the memorial. And I asked him, why are you crying? And he said, I'm not crying because of the memory of the genocide. I'm crying because of the way the government mocks us and mocks our memory and mocks who we are and uses the story of the genocide to obtain funding, to obtain legitimacy in the West, and also to maintain an atmosphere of repression in the country.
But had Kagame been in exile during the genocide, in fact, led the soldiers that overturned the government, the Hutu-led government that had caused the genocide?
Yes, he did.
So he was just seen at that time as kind of a savior.
So that is true. He did wage a war against a government that was genocidal, and he did win that war, thereby ending the genocide. What goes less reported is that during the genocide itself, Kagame opposed, for example, foreign peacekeepers, UN peacekeepers, who would have saved thousands of Tutsis in Rwanda. And Kagame opposed their presence in Rwanda because he felt they would interfere with his military objectives, which were to take over the country. And after the genocide, Kagame's forces invaded Congo and left an estimated, we don't know, hundreds of thousands of people dead, mostly Hutus, in mass graves. And that violence was also largely unreported.
Well, doesn't the war continue to some degree in eastern Congo between Hutus and Tutsis?
There is continued violence in eastern Congo. There are proxy militias that are supported by Rwanda as well.
Now, Moses created a network of journalists in the country, and the government must have known about him. Do you have any idea why his life was spared?
Moses was seen as someone with connections. He had belonged to Paul Kagame's party in the past. And so people were sympathetic to him and would, rather than come down on him, they would come and offer him a little advice. Why don't you stop doing what you're
cool
doing? Yeah.
My guest is Anjan Sundaram. His latest book is Bad News, Last Journalists in a Dictatorship, published by Doubleday. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Before you arrived in the country, did you know what it was like?
Not at all. I knew that Rwanda had been responsible for some war crimes in Congo, but I did not know about the internal situation. And I arrived in Rwanda looking to teach my students and help them be the best journalists they could be. And I was largely oblivious to the extent of the repression in the country. And it was all a surprise for me. And as my students began to be harassed, I tried to help them, as any teacher would.
When did you become aware of the intensity of the oppression?
One of my students was called Gibson, and he was one of my favorite students. He was a wonderful writer, beautiful prose. He was forced to go into hiding and eventually flee the country, and that shocked me. I helped him. I hid him in my house for some time before he fled the country, and it brought me face to face with the fact that here was a person who is leaving his home for an undefined destination, and something powerful must be at work to cause that.
He was writing for a newspaper.
Yes, he was writing for the main independent newspaper, Umuseso, in Rwanda, which was also Rwanda's best-selling newspaper. It was so popular in Rwanda that on the morning of publication, copies would sell out so quickly that vendors would have to sell photocopies. And it was particularly important because it had a number of sources within Paul Kagame's government, people who worked for him officially, but in private felt that the government was doing things that should be reported.
So it was shut down?
It was shut down.
And are you in touch with Gibson?
Yes, I am in touch with Gibson. He's safe. I don't want to reveal too much about him for fear of his security.
Really, would his life be in danger even though he's out of Rwanda?
Yes, the Rwandan government has critics of the Rwandan government have turned up dead in Johannesburg. There have been attempted assassinations. Scotland Yard, even in London, has issued notices to Rwandan critics telling them that their lives are in imminent danger and Scotland Yard cannot do anything to protect them.
Now, Rwanda is a fairly large country. Is the problem everywhere, or would we see a difference in the capital, Kigali, than in the countryside or some of the other cities?
Rwanda is... The Rwandan government is very effective at controlling the country because the entire country has been divided into little villages. Each village consists of 100 families. Each unit of 100 families has one informer and one chief who reports everything that happens within that community to the authorities all the way up to Kigali. And so officials in Kigali have historically and today been very aware and very well informed of what is going on in the country. This was also the mechanism that was used to conduct the genocide, incidentally.
Is the repression applied equally, or is there a certain amount of revenge on the Hutus for what they did during the genocide?
My students who were harassed by the government were both Hutu and Tutsi. The repression takes different forms for different communities and for different reasons, but today Rwanda is a place where both Hutus and Tutsis are repressed by the government, and Kagame has created a very small elite group of Tutsis, mostly, who run the country and have power.
You write that you also grew up under an oppressive regime. Do you think that that made you more aware of what was going on?
Certainly the experience when I was young of knowing that everything that I was seeing in Dubai that seemed innocuous was not, that the newsreaders on television were monitored and told the government line. That realization when I was quite young was a shocking one and made me see the world in different ways, listen to people in different ways.
Is Dubai any better today than it was when you were growing up there?
It's largely the same. Critics of the Dubai government are stripped of their citizenship and sent off to islands.
It is interesting that in Dubai, the tension is Sunni-Shia. Here we have Hutu-Tutsi. Is this a problem in any country that has a divided population?
I think dictatorships often divide populations in order to control. And whether those divisions are religious or ethnic doesn't really matter.
You write that about how language is used differently and takes on new meanings in a dictatorship.
Yes, because you cannot overtly criticize the government, I think criticism comes in very subtle forms. I remember I was driving down a road in Kigali once, and on the radio there was a news release from the National Water Company saying their water bottles were not contaminated, the water that they were selling. Apparently there had been a rumor that had been spread about this water because the company was owned by Paul Kagame. This was a way of dissent.
Now, how much of the problem is from Kagame alone? Is he the face on this government, or is he kind of like Putin, the person who seems to control everything?
All power is concentrated in Kagame, and even his supporters, people who say that he is doing good, would admit that his power is almost absolute in Rwanda today.
Do you think that because you were a foreign journalist, you had special privileges here? Were you safer?
Sure. Yes, I think Rwandans, unfortunately, are far more likely to be imprisoned, tortured, or even killed, whereas foreigners are less likely to.
Was it ever difficult to gain the local journalists' trust?
I think the local journalists were in such a desperate situation when I arrived that they were looking for outside help. And unfortunately, the world, which finances Paul Kagame's regime, has not been a source of support for civil society or journalists.
Do you ever feel pressure from the government, even as a foreign journalist?
Sure, yes. I've had colleagues publish in Rwanda and get calls from the presidency telling them that they are lying and should reform.
And I've heard that you didn't publish many articles about your time in Rwanda.
Yes, because I feared being kicked out of the country, and I felt my primary responsibility at that time was to do whatever I could to help my journalists, my students, who were being harassed by the government. And so I did not publish so I could stay on in the country.
You write about memorials for the genocide occurring every year. What's the stated purpose of those?
The stated purpose is to remember the genocide and so it never occurs again. This is the official purpose. What happens in practice is rather more interesting. There's an element of spectacle around the genocide, and many survivors of the genocide feel disenfranchised from the official memorials and choose to commemorate the genocide in private in their houses with their friends.
Do the memorials, are they intended to legitimize the government?
I think, yes, the government does use the memorials to extend its power and extend its control.
How did the history of the genocide become vital to the regime's repression?
It was a source of Paul Kagame's legitimacy. The fact that he, the narrative that he had ended the genocide, that he was the country's savior, that narrative is one that he continues to impose on the country today.
Are people free to talk about their own experiences during the genocide?
So many, many Rwandans, Tutsi and Hutu, have to simply keep silent about their loved ones and their family members who were killed during the genocide because Paul Kagame's forces and Paul Kagame himself were directly or indirectly responsible for those deaths.
He was responsible for adding to the 800,000 or more deaths during the genocide?
For example, by refusing to allow UN peacekeepers in the country who would have saved lives.
And has he been questioned about that?
Not very much, in truth. And there was, at the International Criminal Tribunal in Rwanda, there was an effort to investigate some of those crimes, but Kagame apparently was able to call Washington, and America and the United Kingdom pressured investigators at the Criminal Tribunal to drop their investigation.
At the back of this book, you have a list of the countries and others who have supported Kagame and allowed this sort of thing to happen. And we are posting it on our website at WMYC.org. It's just too long a list and shocking when you look at some of the companies, governments, etc. involved.
There's been a global syndicate almost to support Kagame. To be honest, repression is an extremely effective way of executing development programs, executing plans. When Kagame says everyone should wear rubber slippers, Rwandans do.
Rubber and slippers, why?
For hygiene. And for example, Kagame banned plastic bags in Rwanda, and plastic bags disappeared overnight. And for many Western aid agencies, such an effective government is a paradise. In India, they're trying to get people to wash their hands and people just don't do it. In Rwanda, all they have to do is get Kagame to tell people to wash their hands.
And why would that be so effective? People aren't afraid they're going to lose their lives if they don't wash their hands.
There are every order that comes from the government is treated with a great deal of fear and pressure. People know that the slightest transgression would be a sign of disobedience, and that is seen really poorly. They could lose access to services. Life becomes generally more difficult.
My guest is Anjan Sundaram, the author of Stringer, A Reporter's Journey to the Congo. He has reported from Central Africa and the Middle East for the New York Times and the Associated Press. And his writings also appeared in Grant of Foreign Policy, Politics, Fortune, The Washington Post, The Telegraph, The International, New York Times, The Guardian, etc. His latest book, Bad News, Last Journalists in a Dictatorship, is published by Doubleday, and we will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Anjan Sundaram. His latest book, Bad News, Last Journalists in a Dictatorship, is published by Doubleday. You write about ethnic tensions being left over from the genocide. Could another genocide occur?
I think it's unlikely that something of such scale would occur. It required many forces to come together for that to happen. But there is a likelihood of mass violence.
The genocide, as horrific as it was to some degree in response to years of feeling repressed. The Hutus had felt repressed, and then the president's plane went down. And hasn't Kagame actually been accused of playing a part in the assassination of the previous president?
Yes, indeed. There have been investigations and court cases because that the downing of that plane was such an explosive, it was a trigger for the genocide. But there's no conclusive proof on either side. What was clear that was that the previous president had many enemies, and one of them was likely to have gotten him in the end.
We were talking about how orderly everything is. You met a number of prisoners, and you say that there was hardly a guard in sight. So people who are imprisoned still would never think of escaping?
So it was quite remarkable to see this group of genocidaires, people who had killed during the genocide some of the worst criminals in the country, at work building a road, and there were no guards in sight, because where would they run? If they ran, they would go somewhere and they would fall into one of those villages, groups of 100 families. Someone would inform the authorities and they would be caught again.
One of the prisoners talked about what it means to be an individual under such a regime. How did he describe it?
He said to me, "We don't know where the state ends and where we begin." And that to me was such a revealing statement. He said to me, "We don't see ourselves as whole people. We see ourselves as agents of the state. And if we don't understand ourselves to be individuals, then how can we see other people as individuals with their own human rights?"
You mentioned that it's easy for the government to get people to wear rubber slippers or to wash their hands, but they also got people to destroy their own homes.
Yes, and the parallels with the genocide were inescapable. I traveled to a part of the country where I was shown by a journalist these homes that were roofless. The roofs were on the ground, the thatch was on the ground, and it looked like a war scene. And when I asked the people, "Who did this to you? Was it the army or the police?" I was shocked by their answer. They said, "We did it." And I said, "Why?" And they said that the local authorities had come up to them and told them to take down their roofs, and they were so scared of disobeying the government that they took down their roofs, and they were now living in the rainy season, in the open, suffering from pneumonia, and some of them were dying.
And why were they told to take down their roofs?
Because Paul Kagame had decided that these roofs looked primitive, and he had said this at one of his speeches, and as soon as he said that, the local authorities all over the country, the heads of villages, went into a panic, and they said, "Oh, we must get rid of these roofs because Paul Kagame thinks they look bad."
But hadn't he offered an alternative, new housing?
He had spoken about that, but they had not been built. And so the local authorities, in an excess of zeal, an excess desire to please the president as quickly as they could, went up to the villagers and told them to destroy their roofs, even though replacement housing had not been built.
This almost sounds like China under Mao.
The parallels are very telling.
At one point during your time there, you heard an explosion from what sounded like a hand grenade. Were people throwing grenades?
There was a spate of grenade blasts in Kigali, and no one knew who they were thrown by. And there were rumors for so long. The government didn't even acknowledge them at first. You would hear the grenade blasts, and you would go up to the scene, and it would be cleaned up. And when you asked about what happened, they said, "No, nothing's happened." And over time, it's so incredible how the government's propaganda can work. Over time, when no one admits to that grenade, the memory of that grenade blast sort of disappears, and you begin to question whether you heard it even.
And it makes the whole act of throwing a grenade almost futile.
In some sense, the grenades were actually thrown as a political message to Paul Kagame. They were thrown beside crowded places, but never into the crowds, or rarely into the crowds. People were telling Paul Kagame, "We can mess with you."
But these were not reported. How do people get their news in Rwanda, and do they really get any news?
What happens in Rwanda is that the government controls all media, and the only narrative that is broadcast in the country is the government's narrative. What happens as a result of this is that people in their homes and in their villages start to believe and tell each other fantastic stories that have very little truth to them sometimes.
What are the Intore? Or is it Intore? Intore?
Intore, yes. It's a word for government supporter. And the government trains students, for example, when they finish high school, they're sent to camps where they're taught to be obedient and taught to praise Kagame. and be patriotic. And these are the patriots of the country.
And you're right about a student in your class, Cato, who turned and became a part of the Entori. Was he trusted by the other students in the class?
No, he wasn't. And I realized this after he left. I heard him on the radio one day, and he was praising Paul Kagame. And only a few days before, he had been talking about free expression, free speech, and the need for democracy in the country.
And then one journalist, Roger, actually turned out to be a government spy.
Yes.
How did you meet him?
He came up to me asking for help. He said he needed to flee the country, and he said I should help him. And he even brought up the genocide when I said I was reluctant to help him, and I was reluctant to get involved. I didn't know who he was. And he said to me, you know, during the genocide in 1994, people were dying, people were hacking into each other, and the world was watching this on TV, and no one helped us.
Bill Clinton just landed on the tarmac at the airport and said, I'm sorry, and then got back in a plane and left.
That was inexcusable. The world...
Is that remembered?
Certainly it is, yes. The fact that the world did so little during the genocide and the fact that the world knew what was going on, there was simply no excuse to not intervene.
One of your students, that Roger that I mentioned, showed you tanks that were given to Rwanda by the American government. Now, what government gave Rwanda the tanks?
So he showed me where they were kept. And actually, a source at the U.S. Embassy told me anonymously that the U.S. had provided Kagame with heavy military equipment, including tanks, to protect Kagame and to prevent a coup d'etat.
And this Roger published an article that was critical of the president. How did he get away with it?
I asked myself the same question, and the answer seems to be that he's a spy, and so he's allowed to conduct these activities. Criticizing the government even adds to his legitimacy.
But you write that by the election, the old guard of journalism was gone, and one of your students was killed. Another, Agnes, was imprisoned. What are they charged with?
So the student who was shot dead had written a story that morning criticizing Paul Kagame, accusing him of being complicit in an assassination attempt. And that same evening, he was shot dead.
The assassination attempt was against General Kayumba?
Kayumba Nyamwasa in Johannesburg, exactly. Mm-hmm. He was shot while in his car, and he is a burly man. He got out of his car and tackled his assailant to the ground and escaped. And my colleague, Jean-Leonard, had obtained information that linked Kagame's intelligence operatives to the assassination attempt, and he was shot dead on the same day he published that report. Agnes, the girl you referred to, who was sent to prison, she was sent to prison for 17 years. She was sentenced for 17 years. She only served 4 eventually. But she was sentenced for 17 years for writing that some Rwandans were unhappy with their leaders.
Did you ever feel that real journalism was dead in Rwanda?
It is dead. The free press has been completely destroyed.
You have an image in the book of a front page of a newspaper that had a profound effect on you.
Yes. There was an article had somehow snuck into a newspaper calling Paul Kagame a sociopath, if I remember. And the editors panicked when they saw this article. And so they published a new edition full of only praise for Kagame. And this was presented as news. And the front page showed Kagame holding his hand over the journalist's head, blessing him and pardoning him.
And the headline was something like...
Sorry.
Sorry.
And there was a little star in the corner of the edition that said, Sorry Special Edition.
Now, does he ever have a press conference?
Paul Kagame does have press conferences where he invites, usually, journalists who are sympathetic to him. If you criticize Paul Kagame, you are barred from those press conferences.
Now, you said that you later learned that in parts of the country known for having resisted the order to kill during the genocide, only 10% of the people had voted for the president. So how did the president treat those areas?
Those areas, the election results, even from those areas, were reported to be overwhelmingly in support of Paul Kagame. And I think it's important to know that even during the genocide, when the order were sent out to kill the Tutsis. There were pockets in Rwanda where people resisted. Unfortunately, they were killed for their disobedience. Now, today in Rwanda, we're in a somewhat similar situation where people who criticize the government are exiled or killed. And so there is only one voice in the country.
Did you ever speak to the foreign embassies about what was going on?
Oh, they knew everything. They knew exactly what was going on.
How dependent on foreign aid is the economy of Rwanda?
They depend on foreign aid for roughly half their budget, so $1 billion each year.
And then they get other, I guess, support from NGOs and such.
NGOs operate on their own budgets alongside government aid, but much of support to Rwanda goes directly to the government or to government-funded projects.
So you said that they knew all about it. When you went to them and you said, oh, this terrible thing occurred, or the government, somebody is skimming all of this money from the foreign aid, they just nodded their heads and said, we know?
Yes, they said, we know. And they would say, some of them would say, that they had no problem funding a dictator. And their goal was to influence Paul Kagame in the right direction, something they've abjectly failed at.
Then people want to leave. Do Rwandan refugees have problems establishing themselves elsewhere?
Rwanda has worked with the UNHCR, the Refugee Commission of the United Nations, to effectively repatriate all Rwandan refugees. They say that Rwanda's safe now, and the UN Refugee Commission has agreed.
When you spoke to the foreign embassies about protecting journalists, what was their response to that?
They did very little. There was very little appetite to do anything that could be seen as angering or displeasing the Rwandan government.
And when journalists ask Paul Kagame questions, are they provided with the questions? Or do they just simply know what the rules are?
The beauty of Rwanda is exactly they know what the rules are. And that's why, incidentally, no one has found an explicit order to commit genocide in 1994. There was no 1C conference in Rwanda like there was in Germany. And there was no need for it.
People went on the radio and priests went in their churches and said, kill.
Exactly. And people knew what the right thing to do was, what the government wanted them to do.
So is this part of Rwandan culture that goes way past Paul Kagame?
Certainly. The structures of control in Rwanda are very old. And what Kagame is doing is to keep these structures in place and even reinforce them.
The period that the book covers ends in late 2013. Is the situation the same? Has it gotten worse?
It's gotten worse. There's no free speech in Rwanda. There have been a couple more assassinations or assassination attempts, and Kagame has become increasingly intolerant in his tone. He has not shied away from even taking responsibility in some sense or linking himself to some of the assassinations, saying critics of the government get what they deserve.
Has there been any response in Rwanda to this book?
A brief response, yes, actually. There have been a couple of press articles locally criticizing me, and I believe I'm told one of them calls me an enemy of the state, but I'm not entirely sure about that.
Anjan Sundaran will be speaking with WMIC's Mathathi Rao on January 19th at Book Court in Brooklyn at 7 o'clock. He'll also be reading from his book and signing copies and taking questions. The book is Bad News, Last Journalists in a Dictatorship. It is published by Doubleday. And Anjan, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you so much, Leonard.